And then obviously everything took a big dive when all that stuff all happened. So like we went below pre-sale price for a while. Our all-time low was about 2 weeks before our all-time high, which is crazy.
Crazy. What? Yeah. That's huge. The Web3 Trenches Podcast with your hosts, KH and Web3 Dev. Welcome to the front lines of Web3, where every week we bring you all the most exciting and relevant developments. All of Web3 with none of the BS. So let's get knee-deep into these trenches. Also, don't forget to participate in the One ETH Subathon we've got going on. Link will be in the show notes. So this week, we are joined by a robot from the metaverse. As a machine, he has no chill. He is co-founder of CultDAO, Revolt, The Rug Game, and now close to launching ZK Layer 2 Modulus. When does he sleep? We have no idea. But I am absolutely delighted to welcome the mighty Artorius.
You guys are far too kind.
I still held back a little, you know?
Yeah, the bit about sleep's definitely true. That's for sure.
I can only imagine. So for all of those who don't know, living under a rock for the past year or two, can you tell us what CultDAO is all about?
I think the best way to describe Cult is either as a decentralized venture capital. The idea behind it is not necessarily to be acting as a VC that's looking for ROI and big returns. That's obviously a factor because we want to bring in money for the DAO, but it's kind of more focused on pushing decentralization and fighting centralized entities. So the main elevator pitch I would give is that we have the Cult token, which has a 0.4% tax on all buys, sales, and transfers. That tax is deposited into a treasury, and then you have the top 50 stakers of Cult, which are called the Guardians, and they can make proposals for investment, and then everyone outside of the top 50 can vote. So if you are a Guardian, you can propose, but you can't vote on the proposals. The idea of that is to skew the favor further towards the many, which is everyone outside the top 50, because I mean, one of the fundamental issues that almost every DAO has is that it's governed by money and whoever's got the deepest pockets. So we're trying to offset that a little bit. You know, there's always going to be compromises made, but in a nutshell, that's what Cult is. So we've made all sorts of investments, such as, well, the recent ones, we invested in like Woofwork, which has done really, really well. And they're like Fiverr or Upwork, but Web3. And of course, my personal favorite proposal, which is the legendary Sons of Crypto.
Hey, let's go.
There's no way I could not talk about it.
Absolutely phenomenal. And we literally cannot thank you enough.
Aside from for-profit projects, I know you guys funding some causes as well. Could you talk about some of the causes?
Yeah, so we did. There's a couple which were on the more radical side. Like, we did an investment into Anonymous, in which we sent them the 13 ETH investment, and I think they used that to buy some hardware to help them with tracking some stuff that was going on in Russia. And then,
that's dope.
Yeah,
that's
been
so dope.
Yeah, it was quite one-sided, that one, in that we didn't get much back in terms of, like, we don't know exactly what they're doing, and I guess that's because they're anonymous, so I can kind of understand that. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, it's kind of marketing at the same time. Like, that's a huge name to kind of side yourself with. People don't want to just do things for marketing and promotion. Every little bit helps, and I think that was a huge talking point within the DAO as well. And that's always a good way to get more engagement within the DAO and to get people talking about the proposal process. And, you know, if it's not a suitable proposal, then why? And then you get to have both sides of the argument aired out, and that generally gets people more interested in the process itself. And then we had another investment, which is one that I'm also very happy about, which is into, they're called One Minding now, but they used to be Unminding, which is the mental health charity that's, you know, it's completely self-run. They don't have any like government funding or anything like that. And that's German Moles, who are always around on Twitter. They do a weekly podcast on Thursdays. So there's a donation to the Dutch farmers as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I saw that.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
I didn't see it. That is so cool. That is so cool. Oh, man, I applaud that.
That was a few months ago now, I think. And then the other one was we bought some pulleys, which were the NFTs that they pulled together the funds to put towards Tornado Cash. It's towards his legal fees. They sold some NFTs called pulleys. Yeah, we bought a few of those. So that was like our donation towards that as well, which is pretty cool.
The funny story, yesterday I saw Gabriel, the king of cringe, raising money for Tornado Cash Dev. And I tagged you, I think I tagged Holly, I tagged a couple of cult people. I was like, if I saw a worthy cause, you know, this is definitely the one. And then these guys could help, and I texted you guys. And Holly replied, "Actually, we already did it way ahead of you." Yeah. So cool. You guys already were on. You guys already donated to that great cause, of course.
I think that happened.
I applaud you guys for it.
Yeah, that happened almost straight after the whole business with Tornado Cash went down. We're really quick on that. I mean, that's one of the benefits of having the Guardians, and also like just the open approach we have to proposals. Like, it's not where, like with traditional VCs, it's everything happens behind closed doors until the deal is done. Whereas we've got 50 Guardians, you know, not all of them are active, but you know, we've got a decent number of Guardians that are like actively looking at stuff that we can invest in. And also, just because everything's on Twitter now, like, we just get tagged in everything, and it means that everyone's really aware of what's going on. So decisions in terms of like what we could potentially look at can be done quite quickly. And I think that's a benefit. I suppose the few pros of crypto Twitter is that everything just gets shared around so fast that it's like you can react to stuff really quickly.
I'd like to ask you as a follow-up question, because you did mention a little bit about your tokenomics earlier. But could you talk us through the tokenomics, and were they specifically designed with this in mind?
Yeah, there was definitely some thought that went into the tokenomics. So the basic structure is that when you have the buys and sales and transfers, you have the 0.4% tax, and that goes straight into the treasury. It doesn't go through anyone's hands, it gets straight into the treasury. And then when a Guardian puts a proposal through, that goes up for vote for 5 days. I believe it's 5 days. I should know that, really, shouldn't I? Then I really should know that. but yeah.
Dude, you've got so much to keep your eye on. I can imagine some granular details get a little bit lost, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Gosh.
And unfortunately, everything in our ecosystem is super complex as well. So my brain's always working overtime, which is why it's always lagging. So we have 5 day voting period where the many can vote that through. So we've had a few where we've had a lot of like almost unanimous decisions, and then lots that have been like a proper battle until the end, which is good to see a mix of both. I think if it was just everything one way, then it would be like, well, people are just voting this through for the rewards, and it's not indicative of people's actual thoughts towards the project. So it's nice to show that people are thinking before they're voting. When it goes through, you have a total of 15.5 ETH, which is allocated. 2.5 Ethereum worth of that cult is burned. It's sent straight to the dead wallet, and then the other 13 ETH worth of cult is sent to whatever the destination address is for that proposal. So when stuff's released from the treasury, it's all held in cult, it's all sent out automatically. So it's not like when someone votes it through, we have to then go, okay, we're going to send this here. So that's like another step of centralization being taken out of the process. So
in our world, we take, you know, DAOs for granted. You know, it's super easy to forget. They have been around for like a very short period of time. Like the first infamous DAO only came around in 2016. And, you know, we know how that turned out. And then DAOs really only got traction like last couple of years, right? So they are still a massive experiment. And you are in a very unique position, you know, being co-founder of one of the most active DAOs out there. You know, with the benefit of hindsight, what would be one piece of advice you would give yourself, you know, before starting cold?
One of the things I wish that we had the ability to play around with is the voting structure. So we renounced the contracts when we first started, because obviously when you have completely anonymous founders, developers behind a project, it's very difficult to build a layer of trust there. So we had to, the fact that all this cult was getting sent into the treasury, there had to be like a show of faith that we weren't just going to run away with that when it got to a sufficient level. So we had to renounce the contracts, and that has unfortunately meant that we haven't been able to like make adjustments and, you know, tweaks to the contracts since we did that. What it would have been, what I think about sometimes is how I would adjust the voting mechanism to make it more decentralized and, you know, fairer overall. I would have liked to have played around with a way that you could even up the votes even more. And I mean, there's plenty of different ways you can do it. I know there's some DAOs that you can have like one vote per wallet, but that still has plenty of issues in that people can just distribute to as many wallets as they have tokens and vote.
On your journey, what was the most surprising thing so far? What you haven't expect, what you haven't expected a year ago?
I definitely didn't expect it to get as big as it's got already.
You should have. It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
You should have.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't expect it to get to like 300 mil market cap in April. Obviously, it's come down since then, but even now, sat at like 40, 43, 45 mil, I still think that's insane. Like, even in just a year, that's like 100x. We launched at like 450k market cap, something like that. So I never expected that. So that was definitely caught me by surprise.
That's at the bottom of the bear market,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
the bear market. Like, after a year of a brutal bear market, where half the crypto collapsed. So
yeah,
well done.
Yeah, it's sometimes I have to just take a sit back and think that's still, obviously don't want to blow one's own trumpet, but I am proud of how well it's holding up. And you know, this last few months it's been so strong recently. I don't want to jinx it, but it's just to see the way that the community's got behind it. It's like I'm not gonna jinx it because I know what will happen if I talk about it, but it's holding so well, and like people are so behind the project. I feel like we have a really, really strong set of like diamond handers. Like there's community members that have been around for a long time.
It is off the charts. Like it continuously blows my mind to see, you know, like a lot of projects, like people kind of get fed up, you know, especially after the brutal bear market and like, you know, Web 2.5 companies blowing up here. You know, we've had all the blow ups and collapses. Like people basically get fed up of crypto. Unless you're like a hardcore degen, people kind of, you know, just give up and peace out and don't pay any attention. But the cult, just engagement, it's off the charts. So I want to ask you your thoughts on the kind of building the community. What would be your advice for aspiring DAO founders? Like, I think, frankly, like one of the strengths, apart from, you know, the dev team and how you guys conduct yourself, the biggest strength of cult is the community. So what are your thoughts on kind of building a strong community?
I definitely agree that our strongest point is our community. I think the most key thing I've found that helps keep our community strong and how we built it is just having a vision behind the project. Like it's not just a financially motivated DAO. It's not just a way for people to try and make money. There's a lot of DeFi out there where, you know, the whole idea is you buy the token, you stake it, and because of what it does, you're going to make loads of money. Like, I hope loads of people do make money from Cult. That would be great. But I don't think that's what brings people in and keeps them there. It's the idea that actually we're trying to do something that's making a change. We're not kidding ourselves into thinking that like Cult's gonna change the world and bring down the whole monetary system on its own. But the idea that everything it's doing is trying to help towards that goal, and it's pushing projects that are trying to do that and be part of that movement as well. And like the more projects you have doing that, then the stronger that movement becomes. So I think that's the key to having the strong community, is just having a focus and something that your community can believe in.
I think that's fantastic. Absolutely correct.
Last question about cult and DAOs in general. Where do you see cult in 10 years? And where do you see DAOs, you know, this great experiment we're participating in now? What do you think is going to be the future of DAOs and cult specifically?
This is a tricky question, because I remember the first time I did Manifesto Mondays, I got asked this question and I just didn't know what to say, because at that point we were so early. But the thing with cult
is... So now you had a year to think about it.
I've had a year to think about that question, yeah. So this better be a good answer, hadn't it? This better be a good one. But I mean, honestly, the thing with cult is it just needs to continue doing what it's doing. You know, hopefully crypto market has grown in there and it's become a bigger industry. I think there's a good chance it will. I think as long as cult's still making investments into like decentralization projects, then that's it's fulfilling its purpose. It's kind of meant to just be this machine that just chugs along in the background, just continuing to churn out these investments into decentralized projects. And, you know, it might be that we've got, like, the vision of decentralization then is different to what it is now. But it's very hard to say what that will be, because this is all tech that's just being developed, like, as we speak. All these evolutionary movements happen in real time, so it's very hard to predict what's going to happen. Whatever it is, I just hope that Colt's investing in that kind of stuff and continuing just to push decentralization-based protocols. In terms of, like, DAOs in general, it's, again, hard to say, but one thing that I've thought about the last few months or so is how, at the moment, everything that's happening in crypto, people are kind of, they're relating it back to financial value. Like, everyone's measuring everything in dollars, and I want it to be the case that we're not measuring against dollars, because as long as we're pegging ourselves to USD value, then we're always pegging ourselves to a shitcoin, because USD is completely messed up, and it's not a fair comparison, because you have the general macroeconomic situation, which is pretty dire, and like, US dollar is not a fixed way of looking at value. So I would like crypto to be valued within crypto. So when I look at tokens, I look at what the ETH pairing's like. Mm. How much ETH am I getting if I swap this back? Because I see ETH as being probably one of the most bullish things in crypto.
No doubt.
I think DAOs should become less financially motivated, in that you're not necessarily, it's not who's got the most value, because it's still a concept that I've just been, like, trying to think about, and it's, how can we do governance that's not necessarily financially motivated? And that's like having tokens that don't necessarily have liquidity. Like, I've been toying with an idea of DAOs that have tokens and voting power, but you're not selling those tokens. You're essentially minting voting power based on engagement and, like, activity, stuff like that. That's kind of something I've been playing around with in my head, and I'd like to see that more in DAOs, where it's gaining voting power through merit and what you're doing, and not necessarily doing that just so that you can make money from it, but doing it to have that voting power. That's like the end goal. So I don't know how that looks yet, but that's what I'd like to see, is more towards wanting the governance rather than wanting the financial benefits of the governance.
That's very interesting.
That's super interesting. Yeah. I think the last thing I want to say about CalDAO, if you are a small team, you know, or individual founder, and you want to build something that is truly decentralized and kind of you think it has legs, I think that by far the easiest way, like the most no-brainer way, is, like, hit up one of the, you know, join Cal Discord, hit up one of the guardians, talk to them. You know, I think by far, like, the least headache, the most value aligned, if you actually care about decentralization, way to get seed round is definitely by Cal. And then the rewards, instead of going to a couple of people at, you know, Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley, they go to the many. So I think it's cool. I couldn't recommend Cult more to the, you know, people who are just starting their projects.
So just listening to that, the most recent idea, how you base trying to get people voting rights through their actions, their good actions, to me it sounded a very similar to what Revolt is trying to do. So my question would be, was that kind of the thinking that led from Cult to Revolt, or what? Then, if not, what is it that kind of led Cult to build Revolt, and what is Revolt?
So Revolt is very similar to Cult in concept, but in mechanics it's quite different, and it's a little bit more complex in terms of, like, the development side of it. So for those that don't know, Revolt is also a DAO that has an 0.4% transaction tax on the token, but it's on Polygon. The idea of Revolt is to have a similar DAO structure, but it's based on individual acts rather than investment into projects. So, like, the max reward amount is 1.5 ETH worth of Revolt. So it's much more scaled towards the individual than a project. So the thought process behind that is allowing people to effectively push Cult and, you know, talk about Cult and the manifesto and stuff like that, but get rewarded for it. And it's almost as if trying to allow people to earn money by pushing decentralization, you know, not maybe directly, maybe indirectly, just by talking about cult. So it was always there. It was always going to be like a support for cult. It works very similarly. You have anyone can submit an actual revolt, but you only have 500 people that vote, and those people are chosen randomly.
So in my mind, it's like the mobilization unit, a support unit for the boots on the ground, you know, to provide them with the resources that they need, given that they have daily lives and responsibilities. So it helps them take time out of their lives to push the good work of decentralization and be rewarded for that, so it doesn't disrupt their lives too much.
So effectively, it's like these people are talking about cult, and they're doing all sorts of things to try and push that message. So why not allow them to do it and be rewarded for it?
I mean, that's super crazy and incredible. And what I also find like crazy and incredible is, I mean, at this point, you're running basically two projects. And most people would think to themselves, I could probably chill now for a bit. I mean, I've done enough. But you, sir, you've decided that two is not enough and you've introduced a third. So could you tell us about the rug game and how it came about and what's all this ruggery all about?
Yeah, I like that, ruggery. Yeah, this one is by far the most complicated one. And admittedly, it took me some time to get my head around it. The rug game is essentially, it's almost like it's based on game theory. It's kind of like a social meta kind of game, and a social engagement experiment, in that you have the main token, which is TRG, the rug game, and you can stake that, and then you have 10 letter tokens. So THE, RUG, G star, A, M, and E star. So each of those letters has its own liquidity pool. And when you burn either cult or TRG, which each of those letters do, then it accrues points to that team. So each letter has its own team. There's 4% tax on the letters. So 1% burns cult, 1% burns TRG, 1% that burns the letter, and then 1% is swapped into ETH and then stored on the main TRG factory contract. So when you have the 10 letters, you have a random period of 30 to 60 days in which the token in the lowest place, so the lowest amount of points, will get rugged. And so it'll automatically have its liquidity pooled. Trust me, I thought this one was going to be a harder sell, honestly. You definitely have to have some balls to tell people they're going to get rugged up front. But the idea behind it is that you're taking part in this game, and it's burning cult, it's burning TRG, but also because you have, there's like two separate reward mechanisms in place as well. So when that letter rugs, the one in lowest place, all of the Ethereum that's in the LP pool buys back TRG and then sends that to people that are staking TRG. So you earn rewards from that, and then you've got the 1% on all the letters, which is swapping to ETH and storing that on the contract. That then gets distributed to everyone that's holding the token that wins. There's definitely a lot of game theory that comes into it. I still struggle to explain it. It's one of those things that doesn't really have, you can't explain it in layman's terms, because it just doesn't.
I can try. It's the Squid Games for crypto.
Basically.
But apparently that's not all. Not even apparently. I mean, if you thought three was enough, like, just to echo the... You guys have just gone and started working on a ZK layer 2 called Modulus. And guys, do you not like sleep or life or what is going on? Can you tell us what kind of led to this idea? And you just speak about it a little bit more?
I wonder if I would still want to have four different projects going if I'd known it was going to be like this at the start of last year.
Surely.
But, you know, sometimes you've got to put in the work and you've got to make sacrifices. But, I mean, the idea of Modulus was that we wanted to be able to have, at the time we started working on it, we had this, I don't know if I'd call it a problem, but it's like an effect where cult can be like an echo chamber, in that you're making proposals on investments, but the trouble is you have 20,000 cult holders that all have their own opinions about what the DAO should be doing. So do you think, should we be should we be investing in this meme coin because we think it's going to 100x? Or then you're going to have like a lot of people that are going to say, no, this is bullshit. That's not what this is about. And then you've got other people that are saying, we want to give this money as a donation to a charity. Then you have people saying, well, what good does that do us? Because there's no reward. So you have all these people with different opinions, and they're kind of knocking into each other in the DAO, because people clash when you have differing opinions about what direction the DAO should be taking. Because that's an effect of us not being in control of it, is that I think sometimes people almost want someone to say, right, we're going to do this and we're going to do that, because it's like you're giving them a sense of structure and security. But that's not what cult's supposed to do. So instead you have all these people that want their own voices heard and their own direction and vision to be seen through. So the idea with Modulus was that we can keep these people in the cult ecosystem, but they're kind of free to do whatever they want to do. So if they want to make meme tokens and degen, they can do that on Modulus. They can launch meme tokens. They can take part in like DeFi stuff. We're building like a DEX on Modulus so that people can do what they want, provide LP, and they can do everything that they want to do on Modulus, and it's still benefiting their cult ecosystem, because cult is the gas token, so it's going to be burning cult for every transaction that's put through. So it was really a way that we could kind of open up this box that everyone has been crammed into, where they're all focused on one little thing, which is the proposal system. But now they can build whatever the hell they want on Modulus, and they don't have to clash with people that they think, maybe I don't agree with the direction they think the DAO should go in. So really it's just to provide an open canvas for people to do what they want to do, but be a part of cult still and benefit cult.
People don't realize kind of difference in complexity between deploying, you know, smart contracts and then building something like Modulus. Like there has to be like two orders of magnitude of difference kind of in terms of lines of code, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah. So this is the thing, it's like there's no secret that we're basing this tech off Polygon ZK EVM. You know, this is the kind of thing where, why would we build a blockchain from scratch when there's tech out there we know is good and we can make it suitable for our purposes? We're not building it completely from scratch, or we'd be here for another 5-10 years, and that's not the kind of timeline that that's not the kind of what's the point in starting a ZK knowledge tech from the very beginning when you know that there's people that have that raised hundreds of millions of VC money to build. We can use that to our advantage. So
I guess, so what you said, you know, people don't realize, like, the people don't actually write their ERC-20s. Like when you want to deploy ERC-20, you use open accepting contracts. Like the vast majority of ERC-20s and NFTs just use, you know, this is the beauty of open source. This is why what we do is open source. You know, like our wallet is open source. We've used Geth, which is open source, right? So this is the beauty of open source. It's like a normal software development practice. But even still, like you said, like I'm at all, like, because it's such a huge difference between, like, you know, deploying a handful of contracts and then kind of deploying, building, forking ZK EVM. Oh, man. I mean, respect. Like, this must be, must keep you up at night a lot.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully, I'm definitely not a blockchain dev. So I'm not the one having to do all the really hard work on it, which is a saving grace, because I think I would definitely be, I would have died ages ago from exhaustion if it was me. Because
so that just leads me into the next question, which I mean, we're all very much suckers for stories overcoming hardships. So, what do you think has been your most challenging hardship, and how have you had to overcome it?
You know, right after we launched, there was a good probably 6 weeks, 2 months where nothing really happened. Like we kind of launched right before the whole Russia-Ukraine thing started, so that was a very tricky time, because it was like everything was slightly going down as it anyway. Part we're getting to the very early stages of like the bear market there, and then obviously everything took a big dive when all that stuff all happened. So like we went below pre-sale price for a while. Our all-time low was about 2 weeks before our all-time high, which is crazy. So
what?
Yeah,
crazy.
Yeah,
what?
So we
that's huge.
I know. So we went, we launched at 450k, I think it was, and obviously like after the launch there's usually like a little bit of excitement and pumping, and we got to like probably 3 million, which then I thought, oh, this is great. You know, that's like a 4X or whatever, or 5X. I think because of how niche the project was, and it was just going down, down, down. So that was tricky, because we kind of thought, oh, we've put all this effort in, not going anywhere, it's dying. And we got to our all-time low, and it was like less than 200K market cap. It was tiny. I don't know what happened. And suddenly, 2 weeks later, it's like 200K to 300 million. And it was just insane. I definitely...
Only in crypto.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Can you imagine if that happened, like, in the stocks? Like, if that happened to, like, Apple or something, it would be ridiculous. It would literally break the monetary system if something like that happened.
And that brings us to the end of our interview with the absolutely incredible Artorias. What an absolute honor.
Sir, thank you for being so gracious with your time.
No, my pleasure. Thank you, Ben. I really enjoyed it.
You legend.
Thank you so much.
And it's a good opportunity, Ben. I told you before, I really appreciate, you know, all your personal and the cult help, you know, us kind of, you guys helping us and stuff. I really appreciate it, man, and respect, man, for all you're doing with the cult and, you know.
That's my pleasure.
So, ladies and gentlemen, today we're trying out a new segment, and this segment is called Demystifying Crypto.
There is a lot of sense around, like, oh, wow, this crypto stuff is really complicated. I don't think that's the case, really. So I want to attempt to demystify it. One challenge with this is, like, every bit we are going to be talking about today, you can, like, spend an entire segment on just on that bit. So we're going to break it down into kind of bite-sized chunks. And over the weeks, we're going to build, like, a knowledge graph. We're going to start with a proof of work, then we go to proof of stake, through optimistic rollups to ZK rollups and beyond. So we're going to talk about the entire landscape.
I'm ready for it.
Okay, so first thing you need to...
So what are we talking about today?
Okay, proof of work. Right?
Start at the start, yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
So first thing you need to understand are hash functions. These are functions that have three properties we care about. They take input of arbitrary length. This could be a sentence, hey KH, how are you doing? Or it could be entire Wikipedia. So it's arbitrary length input, and the output is constant size. The one we care about today is SHA-256, which is, you know, Bitcoin, which is the hash function Bitcoin uses. Basically, it always spits out 256 bits of ones and zeros. Second property is they are deterministic in a sense. Any given input always gives you the same output. So whatever input you put in, you always get the same output. There are so-called one-way functions. What it means is unfeasible to figure out what the input was just based on the output. If you have an input, hey, KH, how are you doing? And you change KH from lowercase to uppercase, the output is dramatically different, right? So, or you just flip like a single bit, the output is dramatically different. So it is unfeasible to figure out what the input was unless you have the input. But it's easy to check because you just put the input, oh yeah, this is the valid hash. Kind of just to give you a sense how infeasible it is, okay? Just you know, like how big 256-bit number is. There are 10 billion stars in Milky Way, okay? 10 billion. There are 10 to the power of 18 grains of sand on Earth. Our entire observable universe has 10 to the power of 22 stars. Okay, this entire universe, observable universe, 10 to the power of 22. 256-bit integer is 10 to the power of 77.
Whoa!
Yeah. Not only that's more than the number of stars in the universe, this actually approaches the number of atoms in entire observable universe, which is 10 to the power of 77, wow. 78. Right. So this is, that's no crazy. Matter how fast computers get, there is no way, you know, the only way to brute force this is like, you know, try A as an input, try B as an input, try A, B as an input, try A, B, C as an input, right? So it's invisible, okay? It's astronomically large. So that's why they call like one-way functions, okay? So we got this. We got the hash functions, okay? Second thing, really, only other thing you need to build Bitcoin is the elliptic curve digital signatures. Only other thing you need is elliptic curve digital signatures. This warrants its own segment. For today, only thing you need to know, if you sign a message with a private key, anyone given a public key and a message can verify you signed it. Think of the function verify that takes input message, signature, and your public key and returns true or false. Right, so you can verify that the holder of this private key was the only person who could have possibly signed this message, okay? So we have the hashing functions and we have the signatures. So with these two tools, we can start beginning to build blockchain. Let's start with the transaction. Transaction is just a data structure that has like a key value pairs, like a phone book, okay? The key would be KH And a value would be your phone number, okay? Key value pairs.
Yes,
but
okay.
These values can also be an array of values. Okay, so maybe you have three numbers. So you have KH and you have your one number, okay?
Yes. Home, cell, right? Etc.
But it can also be another data structure, okay? So instead of being an array, it could be like another key.
Address.
Another key value. Exactly, perfect. Address, yes, street. Yes, okay. Yeah, exactly, okay? So that's a transaction, okay? There isn't really such a thing as Bitcoin. There are only satoshis. Bitcoin is just like a UI. So we're only talking about integers, only satoshis. And there is no such thing as your balance. Okay, there is not like a one integer that represents your balance. Your balance is sum of all the unspent transaction outputs, UTXOs, right? Each transaction has unspent transaction. Each transaction has inputs and outputs. So let's say to your public key, you have two UTXO. One UTXO has 0.3 Bitcoin, and another UTXO has 0.2 Bitcoin. And we had a bet, you lost, you need to pay me 0.4 Bitcoin, okay? So you only have 0.3 and 0.2. So what you have to do, you have to create a transaction, and this transaction is going to have array of inputs. Input number one is going to be your UTXO with 0.3 Bitcoin. Input number two is going to be your UTXO with 0.2 Bitcoin, okay? And then the outputs, one output is going to be my public key, right, my address, with a 0.4, okay? And second output is going to be your address, where you send your change, your remaining 0.1. Okay, do you understand? So this is not, you know, people may think that this is like an integer. No, like the only thing that exists in Bitcoin is these UTXOs. And these UTXOs are locked to public and private keys, right? So if this UTXO is locked to your key, then you can send it. If it's not, you know, obviously, then you can't, okay?
I see.
So it's not like so simple.
It's essentially...
Go on.
So the balance you see is actually just a sum of all your UTXOs.
Yeah, just the UI.
Which is essentially coins that came in minus the coins that you sent, and that's your unspent transactions. So it's a running balance of the sum of your unspent transactions.
Exactly. And this is actually a huge pain in the ass. Because keep in mind, every transaction, there is a different wallet address. So like most wallets, they generate a new address for every transaction. So now we have to deal with all these freaking keys. And you have to go through all the chains and all the transactions to search for each key. Hey, is this transaction output for my key? Hey, is this transaction output for my key? Right? So it's actually a pain in the ass. It's not efficient. There is tricks to make it more efficient, but it's not as simple as, oh, here is a balance. No. It's rather more complex. And these inputs and outputs, so when you kind of declare output in transaction, you have to unlock it. And then again, this is where the ECDSA, you know, comes in, and then you unlock it, and then you lock it to my public key, okay? So then I can use that output to send it. So, and this is really all there is to transaction, okay? Now we have the transaction. You know, it's a data structure, you know, it's just a bunch of data we encoded like this, and now we have the transaction, okay? But just because we have transaction doesn't mean that, how do we get this transaction written to the blockchain? Okay, so we run Bitcoin nodes. There are bootstrap nodes, and any node can connect to us, and we can connect to any node. We send our transaction to all the nodes that we are connected to. And they send it, they in turn send it to all the nodes they are connected to. So our transaction ripples through the network. And in turn, whatever transaction they see, they send back to us. So now we all, you know, this ripples in a fairly fast order. All the nodes on the network create this mempool. This is the mempool you probably heard about, right? So we keep all these transactions that are not yet mine in our memory, in our mempool, okay? Now, my miner comes along, and he looks at all the transactions he has in his mempool, and picks the ones with the highest fees, okay? Rolls up his sleeves and begins to work. Remember those pesky hash function. He hashes all the transactions. He also includes hash of the last block and this random number called nonce. And also, miner includes a special transaction at index zero. This is like the first transaction in a block. And this transaction doesn't need to have input. This is the block reward, right? This transaction, you know, because every transaction can have input output. This transaction doesn't have input. It has block rewards. Plus, there is one extra key there where miner can write any message. This is where Satoshi wrote, you know, Chancellor is on a virtual payload. Do you know what is this key called? This key is called Coinbase. This is where the name of the company Coinbase comes from. This first transaction.
That's super interesting.
This first transaction in a block that is like a minor reward is called Coinbase. That's why Coinbase is called Coinbase, because this is like the part of every block.
Interesting fact. Super interesting fact. That's dope.
Remember the nonce that I told you. It's just a random number. And remember those hashing functions. Yeah. Okay. miner rolls up his sleeve, hashes all the transactions, hashes the nonce, hashes the previous block together. He hashes, gets a hash out, looks at the number of leading zeros. He looks at the number, not enough, facepalm, that changes nonce from 1 to 2, looks at the zeros, not enough, facepalm, changes nonce to 3, changes nonce to 4, facepalm, until he finds a hash that has required number of leading zeros, right? So the hash starts with 0, 0, 0, whatever, whatever. This is the mining difficulty, okay? And this is required by network and dynamically adjusted based on how quickly blocks happen, right? Because on average, it takes actually like trillion hashes, a couple of trillion hashes, and on average, there is a new block found this way every 10 minutes. So you understand, because those hash fractions cannot be hacked, there is no optimization, you just have to brute force it. And this nonce is the only value you can change to try to find a hash with enough leading zeros. But there is no way you can guess it. You just have to freaking try it. Do you see what I mean? Like, do you understand how they mined or not?
Not really.
Okay, so take the hash. As the hash input is all the transactions I want to include in the block.
Okay.
Plus hash of the previous block, plus this random number that I can choose as a miner called nonce. I get some output. And this output is just like a hexadecimal digit, right? It could be A, B, C, 1, 2, 3, 4. And the first X, first three. The mining difficulty is 3. So the first 3 numbers of this hash has to be 0. Okay? If there are 0, I have found a valid block. And I can broadcast this block to the network. I have mined the block. I get the block reward. But you don't know if the first 3 digits are going to be 0. The only way for you to know is to try million different, trillion different nonces. So you try as a nonce, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 4, 5, 6, 8. How many zeros do I have? No zeros. Okay. Try something else. So they just brute force hashing, hash every time. You're hashing the same data. The only thing you can change is this nonce. And this nonce is just number. Okay. So you're trying whatever numbers until you, by luck, find one that actually starts with the number of leading zeros demanded by the network. And this demanded by the network is the mining difficulty.
Can I recap my understanding? Yeah. Yeah, because that is why it's called proof of work, because of all the work that it takes to brute force that hash. And that's why it uses so much electricity.
Exactly. That's precisely
perfect.
Right?
I completely understand.
Like we were saying, this requires like trillion hashes. And then basically, much like transactions are broadcasted, ripple through the network, like each node broadcasts, transaction to each other node and vice versa. It's same with the blocks. When you get a new block, you broadcast it to all the nodes. But before you broadcast either transaction or block, you verify that for transactions that all the signatures are valid. You also check that all the hashes are valid on a block. Because like the miner has to do like a 2 trillion hashes, but you only have to do one to verify that this block is valid. And then if the transaction or block is invalid, you just don't broadcast it through the network. So invalid blocks and transactions, they don't ripple through. And that's pretty much that's it. So now you have the ledger. Then that is absolutely decentralized. Everybody can agree on the state, and it takes a lot of work for you to create a new block. So that's it, man. It's as simple as this.
It is a little bit complicated, but the way that you broke it down is pretty simple to understand. It's very easy to digest. I do have some questions. So when they combine the sender with the previous block,
it's a hash. Right, it's a hash.
Okay,
right.
You just
putting the data in. You just put the data in. Right?
They're just making, making a hash of that. Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not way more complicated than I thought. Yeah, it's pretty simple.
That's a nice thing about the hashes, because you can put the entire Wikipedia and you change one dot and the hash is different, right? So, you cannot fuck with the blocks because, you change whatever about the block. No, it had to be exactly the same, right? So, and again, this is all there is to it. That's why I keep saying, it's not really that complicated. This is all there is to it.
That was super helpful. It really demystified how, in this case, Bitcoin works for me. And I'm definitely looking forward to more of these. The only news worth even speaking about is the market. So in this episode, we're going to combine both the news and the market.
Okay, so here is how I see it. And then Artorias, tell me what you think. Okay, we had Silverbank, SBF, Signature Bank got overtook. One of the board members said that they were not even insolvent. I mean, he hinted that it had to do with the operation choke point, i.e. trying to get rid of cryptos. Don't let good disaster go to waste. What is happening is that there is a bank run, okay? Why? We had a massive bubble, driven by low interest rates. So what banks do? They buy government bonds, the safest instrument they can buy, they can still get a yield on, all right? So then when people want to withdraw the money, they just sell those bonds. But because we had the fastest rate hike in a history, those bonds are now basically worthless. They are trading below market value because the bonds you buy now give you like 4 or 5%, whatever the interest rates are, right? But the bonds you bought last year gave you like a 0% or 0.1%, whatever. And now when people start withdrawing from the bank, the banks cannot cover it. So this is the root cause, as I understand it, basically. And yesterday there have been reports the banks are underwater by $2.2 trillion. Okay, this is just the regional banks. The big banks, there is another trillion there. So there's 3.2 trillion holes on the bank's balance sheet as it stands. Far smarter people than me, which was like Friedberg from Up Only, Arthur Hayes from BitMEX, over the weekend, they have been suggesting this thing. Look, the banks are collapsing. The economy is on a knife's edge. They will have no other choice but to end the quantitative tightening. That means the printers are going to restart. And that was the reason why, after a long time, I switched from stablecoin maximalist to fucking turbo bull. And I went like 5x with leverage long. And this has been working out for me so far. I think basically my view, it's over. Now we are in a situation where you buy every dip. Because the quantitative tightening is over because they have no other choice.
I would say I'm still a turbo bear. A couple of days ago, I was of the belief that about 26.5k, that was going to be the top for the year. And I think we've surpassed that. Obviously, while we're recording this anyway, we've just surpassed that again, touching 27k. But I'm still of the belief that this period of bullishness that we're in now is the top, and it's going to get a lot worse from here. I just think that the macro economy is just so bad, like you're saying with the bonds, it's getting really bad. And also I think too many people are expecting the pivot, and I think it's going to have to really break before that happens. And I think that means that it's going to get seriously rough before that happens. So I mean, I've been speaking to a few people about this, like seasoned market makers, and they are very much of the opinion that we're seeing a double top right now, and that it's going to get really bad. And, you know, later this year, targets of like 10 to 13K Bitcoin. And honestly, I'm finding it hard to argue with that.
Here's my question. Like, the banks are failing because of the fastest rate hikes, right? Now they're talking about, now it's Credit Suisse as well, so it's not just, you know, every day basically there is news about the new bank failing, and then how they have the bank stop them. They have to like, you know, guarantee the deposits. So this guaranteeing of deposits, it's basically printing money. So it's the same thing as QE. So like, how could, do you know what I mean? That's what kind of, it's effectively the same thing. It's QE. Like, if we have like a 3.2 trillion coming into the economy, which basically is going to come from the printers, I think that's end of quantitative tightening, right? That's end of QT. We kind of have to, you know, it's QE in a different name. And I kind of, what I think is like a 3 to 6 months bull market, and then the inflation spikes, you know, has a second spike, and then another brutal bear market. That's what I kind of think. But like, sorry, this is rambling. The question is like, why would you think that we're going to go lower if they are doing quantitative easing?
Like, it is quantitative easing in perception, but Isn't it this is cash that's being loaned to facilitate withdrawals and bank runs. So this is cash that's going straight into the small banks. But if your bank was suffering from a bank run, are you gonna hold that cash, or are you gonna deploy it for yourself? So they're effectively taking that money just to allow people to then continue to bank run their own bank. And I don't think people are like thinking about like the midterm effect after that. And that's why I think this bullishness is happening, because people believe that everything's getting bailed out, quantitative easing's back, and they're going to pivot soon. And I think actually it's setting up something much worse.
Well, I agree it's setting up something much worse, but I think we have some time. I think we're going to see 40k before we see 10k. And I don't know if you're going to see 10k, but let's see. Maybe I am too optimistic. Have you seen that video of Yellen being asked by the Ohio senator about guaranteeing deposit of local banks of Ohio? Have you seen the?
Will the deposits in every community bank in Oklahoma, regardless of their size, be fully insured now? Are they fully recovered every bank, every community bank in Oklahoma, regardless of the size of the deposit, will they get the same treatment that SVB just got or Signature Bank just got?
A bank only gets that treatment if a majority of the FDIC board, a supermajority of the Fed board, and I, in consultation with the president, determine that the failure to protect uninsured depositors would create systemic risk and significant economic and financial consequences.
So what is
and
your plan?
Make that determination.
Right. So what is your plan to keep large depositors from moving their funds out of community banks into the big banks? We have seen the mergers of banks over the past decade. I'm concerned you're about to accelerate that by encouraging anyone who has a large deposit in a community bank to say, we're not going to make you whole, but if you go to one of our preferred banks, we will make you whole at that point.
That's certainly not something that we're encouraging.
That is happening right now.
That is happening because you're not fully insured. And
it just barely met that threshold. You were at Signature.
I'm not certain what the rules are around that. Uninsured investors will be made whole in that bank.
That taxpayers are being made whole in this. The taxpayers are not going to have any kind of consequence on this. I'm sure my bankers are going to be very excited to know they no longer pay taxes. We'll pay higher fees in their community bank.
We're just going to have to move on.
If we have a collapse of the banking system and its economic consequences, that will have very severe effects.
It's insane. Basically, he says, okay. Oh my God, how can the people in China, you know, we talk a lot of shit about, you know, politicians. But just see it like there on display, like how can these people be so incompetent? How can these people be so stupid? Okay, one last thing I think is worth mentioning. I am kind of worried about stables again. And for the people who don't know, you know, cause if the banks are failing and the stables are backed by banks, then the stables are in trouble. You know, we talked a lot on last episode about having stable coins based on like the spot and you know, derivatives. There is one stablecoin I learned about since then called Liquity, LUSD, and basically they have quite small market cap because their stablecoin is backed by Ethereum loans and Ethereum, so they are not super stable. They go like they fluctuate. Their trade off is sacrifice stability for like kind of for you know not having to have a bank. It's an interesting coin. I'm looking at it. I put some of my stables in there. I encourage you guys to check it out.
This is the one I saw. I think I saw Chris Black talking about it on Twitter, mentioning it.
That's how I learned about it. Yeah. I got it. I was in a space with Chris, and he was talking about it. Yeah, that's why I looked into it.
Okay. Yeah, I saw his tweets about it. I haven't looked in depth into them as a project yet, though.
That's the markets. Very interesting insights from both you and Artorias. And now we segue into an update on the wallet.
So I believe that Android has really been making headwinds. I think it's now on 13 modules, which is pretty good. It's almost halfway there. Then on iOS side, I have been working on support for universal router for Uniswap, so that hopefully we launch with support for both V2 and V3 pools on jurisdiction
Huge.
Front. Yeah, on jurisdiction front, so we are waiting for final stamp of approval from Apple. I've been going back and forward with them. I actually freaking even had to go on a phone call with them. So I think now we are basically at a stage where I'm just waiting for status to change from pending to completed, because I think everything they ask for, we provided.
And finally.
But listen, yes. This is from one jurisdiction. This is Dubai. Then there is another jurisdiction. There, we submitted all the paperwork they asked for. This is for the company setup. We submitted all the paperwork they asked for, and I think it's like a matter of days until we are at a stage that we can submit a request another Apple account, separate Apple account. Because at this point, I'd rather have like a 2 or 3 Apple accounts at the same time, and then let's see which one gets there first. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, it's, you know, all the pain that we've gone through, I think it's good to have redundancy. So that one seems to be close as well. So I'm very optimistic about finally being able to stop dealing with this crap.
No, well, that's amazing. That's amazing. I mean, finally, we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. The struggle of a founder. And speaking about founder struggle, I think that perfectly segues into our Founders in Focus segment. Mike is currently worth $15 billion. The annual profit of his company he started is $1 billion a year. He never went public, and to this day, he owns about 80% of the company. Mike came from a middle-class background. However, his father never made more than $60,000 a year. But what his father did do is teach him the value of hard work, intellectual curiosity, and ambition to strive relentlessly for his goals. Young Mike, fresh out of business school, wasn't really too sure what to do. His friends told him to call up the Solomon Brothers and Goldman Sachs. Not having much of a better idea, he did just that, and he landed a job at the Solomon Brothers. At this time, securities trading and sales were kind of seen as second-class occupations. But this was probably a mistaken opinion, since both essentially involved picking up the phone and talking to customers, which is sales. There's even a quote in the book, "Life is sales." You have to sell yourself to potential employers, potential life partners, and you've got to sell your vision to your employees. Whatever you do in life, you will need sales skills. Mike arrived at work every single day at 7 a.m. The only other person there was his department head. So every day he had a coffee and a chat with him, and usually he left around 7 p.m. And the only other person there at that time was the department's second in command. And they often ended up talking and taking a cab ride to downtown together. None of the other 26-year-olds in his department put in crazy hours like Mike. Mike was unapologetically extreme. Of course, he was first in line for any promotion. He was, in fact, promoted to the information department, and he was in charge of systems that provide analytics and tools for traders. After about 10 years of 12-hour workdays working 6 days a week, he was let go. He didn't wallow in despair. I suppose his $10 million severance package certainly helped. But later, he said it was the best thing that ever happened to him. Sure, $10 million is a lot of money, and it's a fortune that we all aspire to build, but it's certainly not $15 billion. Mike, again, was unapologetically extreme. In 1981, at the age of 39, with a wife and two small kids, he immediately took $4 million of that and put it into his own company. His business focused on building an information, analytics, and trading tool service. The PC revolution was yet to take place. So they were building mainframes and market master terminals. They installed them in large financial institutions during the weekends. Development took a bit longer than expected, and he became worried that he'd sunk most of his money into this project. One thing he highlighted was that they brought in traders, asked for feedback, and iterated. So when the product was finally shipped, it was a trader's dream. They launched a news publication as a growth hack. Each article included graphs and charts from the terminal, essentially functioning as a demo for their main product. And this strategy worked phenomenally well. He ended up giving speeches and interviews, always presenting data from his Market Master terminal. Another lesson he mentions is not to mistake your technology for your product. Kodak thought their product was cameras and film, when in reality it was photographs. They went out of business due to this mistake. Mike knew to avoid this error. They got out of the hardware business and started using off-the-shelf PCs. He knew their product was information and not just the machine displaying it. He also emphasized the importance of learning and mentors. Elon Musk once said he didn't have a network of mentors when he got to California. His mentors were Benjamin Franklin, Edison, Ford. And by that, he meant reading their biographies. So there's yet another great lesson. He says, don't devise a five-year plan. Central planning did not work out for Stalin and Mao, nor does it work out for entrepreneurs. He advises to take the best-looking step that you can think of at any given point and then evaluate and iterate. Mike continued giving interviews and speeches and producing articles, essentially becoming an influencer. His product became synonymous with his name, so they renamed it to the Bloomberg Terminal. He, of course, ends up serving as a mayor of New York with a $15 billion network. And at age 81, he still happily goes to work. What a guy.
I'm particularly fond of this story. I'm particularly fond of it because what he did do, basically, he did software and content marketing. He learned state-of-the-art when he was, you know, at the information department in Salomon Brothers. And then he thought he could build something better. Well, that's kind of what I'm trying to do. I was working for like the biggest bullet and trying to build something better.
So many similarities from,
He created a content marketing funnel. And then, you know, that was the fuel for the terminal
business. Exactly.
Well, that's what we're trying to do here with the podcast, to create a content marketing funnel.
Absolutely.
So let's hope we are on the right track and we'll be worth $15 billion someday.
Ooh, manifesting. Let's go.
Oh, God damn it. It's manifesting bullshit. Okay. This book has so many great quotes. I struggled to pick just one, but like a few. The person who had been really thrilled is my father. All the success I've had would mean even more to him than it does to me. Today, 55 years later, I still miss him. Most fortunes are built by entrepreneurs who start from nothing and generally got fired once or twice during their careers. Throughout the history, vast majority of writers, artists, athletes have come from less financially secure families. The rewards almost always goes to those who are willing to outwork the others. The time you put in is the single most important and controllable variable determining your future. And perhaps my favorite quote from the book: by endurance we conquer.
How cool is that? Absolutely, man. Absolutely. That's so dope.
So basically, we talked a lot about cult community, and I actually have a little surprise. Harry was gracious enough to invite me for the Drink with Cult at ETH Denver, and here is a couple of interviews from this mad and mighty community we heard so much about.
Hi, I'm Harry. I'm building Walletport. My main take from ETH Denver would be that the serious builders that are out there that want to build public goods, noble causes, and this is something that we're doing at Cult DAO as well. And to see a lot of people approach our booth and speak about our mission without knowing what we're doing is great to see.
Hi, I'm Mad Cultish, and my highlight of the conference was meeting Web3 Dev.
Okay.
I was already...
Now say the real highlight. Now say the actual highlight.
So it was actually like... One of my favorite things is to talk about cults, but what was more meaningful to me was being able to meet everyone that I've been getting to know over the past year on Twitter and Telegram and Discord, and getting to see them in person. That just made me that much more bullish on cults.
I'm part of the many. My name is Exo. Everyone knows me since I do spaces pretty much all the time. This ETH Denver event is pretty fire. I want to see more people at ETH Denver, and come see Cult DAO, obviously. The people from the Cult DAO booth is amazing. Meeting people all over around, it's pretty amazing to actually meet people in real life. Web3, I gotta tell you guys, Web3 is a legend. We're having a great time with everyone here. Like, Harry's here from Walletport. We got Holly over here from Cult DAO Guardians. We have Joe Broadcast, who's a new guy from Cult DAO. We got Tig Legend over here. We got Hexoshi. We got Mike from Vamp, The Empire. We got Mr. C, Big Chad. We got his brother, Matt Cultish, in the house. Guys, you do not want to miss ETH Denver next year.
My name's Mike from Vemp, and the highlight for ETH Denver for me was meeting a lot of interesting people that are doing groundbreaking developments in crypto space.
Hi, I'm Hexoshi, and my highlight from ETH Denver was getting to meet all of my cult community members and going out and hearing about other people's projects, meeting interesting people, and furthering the revolution.
Hi, my name is Estefano. I'm the CMO of Vemp. The highlight for me for the event is that September Morganer, there is a lot of really cool protocols building ZK tech for businesses to make better decisions when they come to spending their marketing dollars, but at the same time protecting user privacy. And I think that to me is fucking amazing.
Hi, I'm Holly Hart, and this experience at ETH Denver has been amazing, and the highlight for me is just seeing how everybody has come together. The day before, with doing the work, we had everyone putting their hands together with putting the masks together. We even had the guys from VEMP helping us out, putting the masks together, punching out the holes with the eyes, putting the elastic bands on, slapping stickers on there, and everyone was just sitting at the table working together, and we were a chance to get to know each other and to talk to each other. And you know, we've felt this camaraderie with each other, and it was just really great getting to know each other in person and seeing each other. And I think we're making friendships for the rest of our lives, and that is the highlight for me, is making those connections with people.
My name is Mr. Coltmander of Colt Dow. My biggest highlight of ETH Denver was meeting Web3 Dev.
Okay, now say the real highlight.
My real highlight is getting the opportunity to be interviewed by Web3 Dev.
Okay, and now the real highlight.
My realest highlight is meeting some of the biggest OGs in the Ethereum community, getting to know them and learn from them and seeing how we could use that to benefit Colto.
How tired are you by now?
I could fall asleep for about a week.
Big T and KC, Lambalicious Bag Lady, and the highlight of ETH Denver was being able to talk about hope and be able to talk about Bank of Nowhere. It was so amazing to be having people coming through the table and saying, hey, what is this? And I'm like, and you can turn this over and you get a free NFT, and the people are so excited.
He said, much of the immediately called family, that was by far the best highlight of the year. Getting to be the absolutely amazing and always positive ex-OC. It's just the family, there's no family like the whole family.
And on that bombshell, we end the show. So don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Web3D3V and at GESSTARR. Also, be sure to follow Artorius. Check him out on Twitter at Artorius_ETH. Let me spell it. ArtoriaS_ETH. And of course, do not forget to check out cultdao.io. Also, don't forget to participate in the 1 ETH subathon we've got going on. Link will be in the show notes. And once again, thank you for tuning into this episode of the Web3 Trenches podcast. And until next time, keep digging deeper and deeper.
She is a freaking like stand-up comedian. She's a queen of one-liners. The first time I met her, I didn't know who she was. I was like, it was after my first day, and Harry was like exhausted. He was tired. I was like, this is the first time I see you instead of talking. And she was like, nah, he always looks like shit. That project, you know, with the project, like, what was the difficult part with Cald or something, you know, like, some drama in Cald or something like that.
Oh, there's plenty of that.
Or even
plenty of that, for sure.